From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. What makes a city special? The towering architecture near your workplace, that street corner where you catch the bus, those spaces and places that remind you of community, both past and present. Well, that's part of what journalists from The Guardian, a UK-based newspaper, are seeking during their week in Atlanta, that special quality that defines place. This place. The project is called Guardian Atlanta Week. Chris Michael is the editor of Guardian Cities. Hello, Chris.
Hi.
Hi, and Tosh Reith Banks is production editor for Guardian Cities. Hello, Tosh.
Hi there.
And Mark Oliver, he's the Guardian's U.S. Special Projects editor. Hello.
Hello.
They have gone to Atlanta United games, explored the future of black art in the city, been to Netherworld, and they're tracking scooters that are popping up everywhere on our streets. They're in the studio to discuss what they found. Now, Chris, I'm going to start with you. Guardian Cities has profiled Jakarta, São Paulo, Mexico City. Reporters spend a week in a place filing stories. It's not a lot of time. So how do you instruct them on what they're looking for?
Well, the key thing to do really is just go to people who already live in the city and already report from there. I mean, when we show up in a place, we don't really necessarily know that much about it. I mean, we obviously spend a lot of time reporting and getting stories and publishing stories on cities around the world. But when we go to a specific place and do a deep dive like we're doing in Atlanta, the key really is to get locals to help you.
So what have you been hearing, Tosh, from locals?
Really interesting things, actually. As has been noted before, it's very much a city of transplants. And that's certainly true of the journalists that we've worked with and certainly true of the people that we've met while we've been here. It's a city that's changing a lot and has changed a lot in the last sort of decade or so in particular. And people seem to have a lot of affection for it. A lot of people have come here for a specific reason, whether that's work. I mean, I've done a lot of research and work around people coming in for the film industry and for sort of other slightly more abstruse, nerdy reasons like the horror industry. And it's a very, very interesting vibe.
How about for you, Mark? How do you find the essence of a city in a week? Where do you even begin?
We started off with a kind of like a question, really, which was which US city should we do this in? And I don't think there was any one reason why we looked at Atlanta. But I mean, for me, like I was watching the Donald Glover Atlanta FX program and loving that. And so it was sort of starting to get into my kind of like mind. And we just thought that it was such an interesting moment that Atlanta was having where it's kind of culturally becoming more and more recognized, and we wanted to try and kind of like tune into that and look at the film and the TV industry, and also all sorts of kind of like challenges. It's growing in population, and kind of with it, you know, Georgia as a state will become more politically powerful, and we wanted to kind of try and, you know, get under the skin of some of those things, you know, coming in as an outsider, but you know, trying to understand them a bit more and build up a kind of a portrait of a city.
I'm curious if your expectations matched up to what you thought might be here. How about you, Chris?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm originally from Toronto in Canada, and Atlanta weirdly reminds me a lot of Toronto. It's a city poised on the cusp of great change and really feels almost like a quintessential North American city construct with tons of sprawl and lots of old buildings having been knocked down to build flashy new skyscrapers, but also a real effort, especially among younger people, to recapture the center of the city and to densify and to build public transit and to encourage cycling and the scooters and everything else. So it's, in some ways, you know, we sort of saw Atlanta a little bit, maybe the way that Chicago was in the 20th century. Atlanta sort of embodies the sort of new American city of the 21st century.
So what kind of visions of the city did the people that you were collaborating with give you? Who wants to pick that up? Tosh?
Oh, crumbs. Okay. Well, we've spoken a lot to Ryan Gravel about the Beltline. We've got a big piece coming out about that tomorrow. And that's a very interesting vision of the city, particularly because it speaks to, in some ways, the divisions of the city. You can see how the Beltline will definitely improve certain things, including transit. But you can also see that it's having a knock-on effect that's perhaps less desirable. The gentrification, which a couple of people have noted to us as being a particularly Atlanta problem.
And that seems consistent with the history of Atlanta, these surges of development and then retrenching somewhat. Did you hear that from people?
Absolutely. And our deputy editor, Nick Mead, actually wrote a piece yesterday about the lost city of Atlanta, referencing this idea of it being a very tear-down city, you know, with some fantastic buildings that are completely lost to, you know, to the archives, basically. But yeah, it's a city of movement, definitely.
Well, a city of movement that's also deeply planted in the South. But I hear from a lot of people that they don't say they're from Georgia. They say, I'm from Atlanta. Did you find that distinction?
Well, one thing that really struck me was Atlanta United. We were really excited about that story. And I don't know if this is true, but it felt like with people kind of moving to the city, that something had kind of been captured by that new side, where it was a kind of like a moment for a lot of fans that we spoke to who were from elsewhere, who might have baseball teams or football teams elsewhere, that they could kind of get behind this new soccer team and kind of like lay down some roots in Atlanta. And it's just, we spent a bit of time at the tailgate at the game on Sunday. And it's just amazing, this kind of like fan culture that had kind of like come out of nowhere and the excitement around it.
Yeah, they've completely, the team has completely swept the city. But that's something that Atlanta folks are certainly familiar with. So who are you envisioning as the audience for these city profiles?
I mean, that's an interesting question. I think, you know, we have a global readership. And when we decide to go deep on a particular place, we want to make sure that the stories that are happening in that place resonate with readers around the world. That said, we've seen a lot of our readership from Georgia. 28% of the people who've been reading the articles in the series are from here, which is really heartening because obviously these are the people who know the place best. And we've received a tremendous flood of comments from local readers telling us, you know, things that we should do, things that they think we didn't get right, things they, you know, didn't know about their own city. So that's very exciting.
That's Chris Michael. He's with Mark Oliver and Tash Reith Banks. They're all from the newspaper The Guardian, and you can read their coverage of Atlanta. It's this week at theguardian.com. Of course, you can read it afterwards as well. And I'm wondering, do you think this is going to become a reference point for, you know, somebody has a week in Atlanta? They might actually retrace your steps.
I hope so. So I was talking to my sister the other day, who lives in Durham, in the north of England, and she was saying, oh, actually, one of my colleagues is going to Atlanta this week to go to the Walking Dead, you know, one of the 80,000 people that are going to flock to the big conference about that. And that kind of sort of surprised me, really. Like, you know, when I was growing up, Atlanta wasn't really on the radar of, you know, a place that people in the north of England would visit. And so, you know, hopefully we'll pick up some readers who, for one reason or another, whether they're a fan of, you know, a bit of the culture that appeals to them, you know, suddenly wanting to know a bit more about the city in the round.
What surprised you most about Atlanta?
I mean, I didn't realize that Atlanta was the most unequal city in the United States.
This is a big, big part of what it is.
Absolutely. And the place does feel quite divided. At the same time, it's tremendously integrated, or feels quite integrated racially. And so that, we thought, made it a really interesting place to go deep on, because of this sort of what seems like a paradox. It is both incredibly unequal and yet in some ways quite progressive.
So that's one of those things that obviously there's a lot of information and research about this, that about the inequity of Atlanta. But as an outsider, maybe you get a different kind of perspective. How do you see it or interpret it?
I mean, we were in a taxi last night going to Ponce City Market, and we could just sort of see how there were, you know, these neighborhoods that were project housing right next to these kind of condos that were going up. And it was almost like you could just see the two different, you know, universes of Atlanta literally over the other side of like a street.
What are the other things that you saw that maybe surprised you? How about you, Tash?
Oh, I'm trying to think about it. I have to admit, I'm not exactly surprised by Atlanta, but I have enjoyed it, which is perhaps more surprising to me. I had never thought of it as a place to visit. I mean, we go back to the idea of it being a sort of people saying that they are from Atlanta rather than from Georgia. I'm from London. A lot of people do sort of say, I'm from London. I'm, you know, rather than I'm from England or I'm from the UK. There is this liberal island idea. And I've been very interested by how that sort of might manifest here. The other thing that I have been really, this is potentially slightly controversial, but the other thing that I have been quite surprised by, again, coming from the UK, is the prevalence of the gun culture. I used to work in the scare industry, and I went to a haunt the other night, and it's the Pink Trap House, the haunted Pink Trap House.
TI's Trap House.
Yeah, that's right. And it's very interesting. They have a section which is zombie kill, and it hadn't occurred to me until I was inside that there might be an issue with people bringing their own weapons in. It's honestly not a thing that has ever occurred to me before. And then I started seeing, you know, here and there and about, you know, don't bring your weapons inside this coffee house or whatever. That surprises me. But it shouldn't surprise me because I know what the gun laws are here. It's just a cultural difference. And very, very interesting to see that manifest itself in a very modern-looking city.
And you said, you started by saying Atlanta's not that surprising. What did you mean by that?
I just meant that I sort of recognised it as an international and global-looking city. You know, it's less antebellum South than anywhere else that you might be anticipating in the South. But I was aware of its reputation as a place that regenerates itself constantly, or, you know, sort of reimagines itself constantly. So in many ways, I wasn't surprised to see how shiny and new a lot of downtown looks. You know, the beautiful Mercedes-Benz Stadium, it's got a lovely atmosphere, but it's very, very futuristic looking. I wasn't surprised by that as such. But yeah, it is not. It's not the South of your imaginings. It's not, you know, Spanish moss dripping off the trees and whatever. Certainly not downtown anyway.
What do you think readers here in Atlanta will take away from this series, seeing it from another perspective?
You asked before about, you know, what you notice coming into a place for the first time. And today we've just published a multimedia piece about Stone Mountain. And it's that was something that really struck us looking at it from the outside. And it's something that it feels like Atlantans have just seen for so long that to them it maybe doesn't register as quite as strange as it does to us arriving from the outside. One of our colleagues, Emily Cozart, is from Atlanta. She wasn't born here, but she grew up here. And she told stories. She was actually how we first sort of cottoned on to the phenomenon of Stone Mountain. She said, you know, she used to go there as a kid and they would picnic and they would watch the laser light show that's projected onto the Confederate monument. And she just sort of, you know, took this for granted and thought it was all lovely and fine. It was only when moving away that she started to think, well, that was a little odd, wasn't it? And now in the context of the movement around the United States to remove Confederate memorials, the sort of gigantic Confederate memorial that you can see from the plane flying into Atlanta, all of a sudden to us, seemed like an incredible story to tell.
Chris Michael, Mark Oliver, and Tosh Reith-Banks from The Guardian. You can see their multimedia coverage and read more about their coverage of Guardian Atlanta Week. We've got a link at gpbnews.org. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you very much.
Coming up next, we take a visit to Savannah and hear from Sonny Seiler, the man who owns Ugga, the famous and beloved Bulldogs mascot. This is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Over the past few months, I've learned a few things about living in Georgia. Being called ma'am is not an insult. Every carbonated drink is a Coke. And spending a Saturday between the hedges does not mean doing yard work. Football is in the blood, and Frank Sonny Seiler bleeds red and black. Sonny is a double dog. He got his undergraduate and law degrees from the University of Georgia, but he is best known as the owner of Ugga, the white English bulldog that is the mascot for UGA. There's actually been a series of 10 Uggas.
Okay, was this the original Ugga? With these cheerleaders, looks like could be from the 50s. That's the original UGG, the big one up there top. And that's Coach Wally Butts in the background up on the right.
My colleague Sarah Shariari and I visited Sonny in the genteel Savannah suburb where he and his assistant, Betty Ford, yes, Betty Ford, were clearing out office files. Sonny was a successful lawyer and famously a character in John Barrett's best-selling nonfiction book, Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, which we will get to. But first, I asked him about the origins of UGGA.
I had just gotten married, 1955, and I had a job in the athletic department selling tickets in my first year in law school. I would go there every afternoon, sell tickets if I could. We weren't very good in those days. Didn't sell a lot of tickets, but it was a good job for me, and I needed a job like that we did. It was good.
Newly married and with a baby on the way, fate called on Sonny Seiler by way of his mother-in-law. And this, by the way, dispels the legend that the dog was given to his wife, the former Cecilia Gunn, by an old boyfriend as an insult to Sonny.
Cecilia's mother called us and said that a friend of Cecilia's in Columbus, where she was from, wanted to give us a white English bulldog as a wedding present. Well, we could hardly feed ourselves, but we couldn't turn that down, so we accepted. And when we went and picked the dog up, he didn't look anything like I figured he would look. He was tall and gangly, and he hadn't filled out, but we took him anyway. That was in April. By September, he had filled out, and he looked great. He looked like the hood on a Mack truck, really. Big, broad shoulders, big head. Cecilia went down to Penny's and bought a size 8 red child's t-shirt and put some elastic in the legs and around the waist, and she cut a black G out of felt and sewed it on. And he looked like a mascot. Well, the first game that year was with FSU, of all teams. We took the dog over to the Sigma Chi house. And he made a hit over there because everybody was hooted up with iced tea, you know. So somebody said, let's take him to the game. Let's take the dog to the game. Everybody said, take him to the game. So we took him to the game, not on the field, not trying to invade into anything, but took him up in the stands, and he attracted a lot of attention. What's more, we won the game. We beat FSU.
The next day, Sonny went to pick up his tickets to sell and found a note which said,
Coach Butts wants to see you in his office immediately. Well, I said, oh my God, you know, I can't lose this job. I didn't know what I'd done. His office was right over mine in old Stegman Hall. And I knocked on the door. He was over there looking out of the window. And he says, come in, Sonny. He says, Dan tells me you got a English Bulldog might make us a good mascot. What do you say? Let us use him. Mike died. We don't have a mascot, and I don't seem to be affording much entertainment. You know, what am I going to say? I said, of course, Coach, if you think he can help our program. He's good. Have him at every game. He turned around and went back to looking out the window. That's the way he was. So we took him to every game. Now, he has missed some games. Not many.
Did you feel like you had to carry this on after?
He said have him at every game. And I had 2 more years in law school. And it's not the worst job in the world. But I didn't know that it'd ever get to what it is now.
Does he fly first class?
He goes with the team. Wherever the team goes, we go. And if the team flies, we fly. Unless it's a short trip. They're all good travelers. They're all well cared for and well taught, well trained, and we've never had any real trouble with them. We've had some interesting experiences with them, but never any real trouble with them.
I promise we'll get to that, but first a little background into life as UGGA. He's kind of jet set. Home games in Athens, he's got a suite at the Georgia Center. Yes, a suite. 3 bedrooms and a sitting room. There are lots of paparazzi shots. He travels in his own vehicle, and there are a lot of other high-ticket perks. But lest you forget that he is a dog, here's a story from a day that Sonny's daughter Swan was minding UGGA.
I don't know whether you've ever been up to the skyboxes in Sanford Stadium, but they're quite nice.
I have not.
And only the elite go up there, and it costs a good bit of money to be involved in that club. And at halftime, they serve scrumptious hot lunches. But we would take Uga up there, particularly in the early games, and let him walk up and down and cool off, because great air conditioning up there. And it gave those people an opportunity to see him close up. Well, they never have that opportunity, sitting down in regular stands. So she took him up this day. Well, at the far end of the hall, the Georgia alumni has a suite of its own where we can entertain people at football games, and we do. And so Swan was on her way down there with the dog to start taking him back to the field. Well, right ahead of Swan was a caterer pushing a steel cart down the hall to go into one of the skyboxes and feed the multitude. Well, on the bottom shelf of that cart was an open pan of beef tenderloin with demi-glace sauce, right even with you-know-who's head. So he did what any dog would do when presented with such an opportunity. He stuck his head in and got himself a big mouthful. And the caterer caught him and hit him with the towel, cussed him out. He didn't care. He had his. And then suddenly, listen to this part. Swan got the dog away from there. Everybody was laughing and carrying on. The caterer takes a fork, smooths the tray of beef bouillon over.
No, he didn't.
And he pushes it on into the skybox to serve lunch. We don't tell who's skybox now. But that was a very funny experience.
Swan and son Charles have picked up the family tradition, or leash, as the case may be. Charles has had the last three dogs, 7, 8, and 9. Uga 10 lives with Charles now, which is why you don't hear an English bulldog in this scene, just the occasional chimes marking the passage of time.
You said you never suspected that this was going to happen, this Uga phenomenon. But what has it brought to you in your life?
A lot of fun and notoriety, but the notoriety's all been good. Got to see a lot of football games that I wouldn't have seen otherwise. We ride to the games in a Suburban, red Suburban, that opens up in the back. His kennel will get in there, and he's cool. His greatest problem is heat, because it's a respiratory thing with English bulldogs. They pant a lot, and that causes them to suck in impurities, which leads to sore throat, which leads to God knows what. If you don't catch it in time, it can be bad. But all of that's behind us now. Thank you.
You've seen quite a few of them come and go. That must be...
Well, this is 10.
This is number 10. I don't know. It must be hard that in this position, you lose a dog and you know, okay, I have to get another English bulldog.
No, not quite. When we can, we anticipate that we'll need another one. And it's not necessarily because they're in bad health, but maybe they're just getting too old to do the deal. Because when they get about 8 years old, they lose a lot of that energy that made them so attractive. We don't retire them at that age, but we have retired a dog when he was too old to go anymore. We had a good puppy in the wings waiting. So, you know, we don't have to go shopping around. We've been caught off base like 7 and 8. But we had looked ahead, and we knew what we were going to do.
Not a bad life for a dog, even if you have to, you know, steal tenderloin every now and again.
Well, if he's given a chance.
Sonny does not want to talk about breeding dogs or selling puppies, which he emphatically denies. He says first, he's a pet owner, and Uga has for years been voted the top mascot in college football by fans and by Sports Illustrated, among other publications. The ranch house we visited was once the Seiler family home, and the walls are covered. It's like a museum of Uga, plastered with photographs. In addition to introducing Uggas, Sonny had a long career as a lawyer, a really famous lawyer who defended prominent antiques dealer Jim Williams, accused of murdering his gay lover. It's the basis of the mega-selling novel Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil. That 1994 novel covered four murder trials running over 8 years. The case stunned Savannah and was a boon for tourists looking for eccentric characters and sites portrayed in it.
Well, you are beloved as the man who brings UGA to games and has for decades now. How about as a lawyer? Famously written about in the book by John Berendt, that has done a lot for Savannah in many ways.
I'm glad you recognize that, because I think the city may have dropped the ball there and not given it the real credit, or John Berendt the credit that he deserved. But they realize that now, and they're trying to make up for it. You can find people that like the book and people don't like the book. People like the movie and they don't like the movie. But you can find out about any movie. But this was a special movie done by Clint Eastwood with wonderful cast. The book still has the record on the New York Times bestseller list.
Did you like how you were portrayed in the book? Did you feel like it was accurate?
Yeah, it was just a lawyer doing a job. But yeah, they didn't do anything bad to me or any of the lawyers that I remember. And in the movie, that was a lot of fun. I was hoping I could get in on the jury. That's what I wanted to do.
You were in the movie, right, as a judge?
Yeah, but Clint Eastwood tabbed me to be the judge, and I enjoyed that because all that was shot out in Hollywood.
Mr. Tucker, did you ever have sex with Billy?
No, sir.
Are you yourself a homosexual?
Objection. Relevance?
Mr. Lodgen, you open that door. What's good for the goose is good for the gander. I'm gonna let it in.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I wanted to be on the jury to say after 8 years we find the defendant not guilty. I figured I could get the jury to let me do that, but Mr. Eastwood had other plans.
It's ironic that given that so many films are made here and the sense of place in that movie is so strong that it was made in Hollywood instead of Savannah.
Just certain parts of it. All of the parts from the courtroom were made out there, and they built the courtroom, which was fantastic. I told Mr. Eastwood, I said, you know, this courtroom is better than most of the courtrooms we practice in, and it was.
What was it like for you going through the filming of this to relive these trials that were such a big part of your life?
Well, it had been a long time now, and I'd gotten so used to it that it certainly didn't bother me at all, and it entertained me a lot. The cast was wonderful.
How did you like the portrayal of you?
Jack Thompson was excellent actor and still is, I think. Hope he's still around. He's from Australia.
Is he as good a lawyer as you are?
I don't know. We never have battled.
You said that Savannah kind of missed the boat on that book, at least initially.
They did.
Well, how so? What didn't they get about it? They didn't capitalize on it?
You just said it. And if they did, it was the wrong way. They didn't flip it right, as they say now, you people.
For me, lived up in New England when I read it, New York maybe. Yeah, New York when I read it. And I thought, wow, this is a fantastic, mysterious, character-rich place. So in many ways, there are people who consider that book to be almost the caricature of the South, the Southern Gothic.
Well, you know, the people that don't like it now are people who feel that their ox is in the ditch. It depends on, you know, how you look at life and how you looked at what the happening. But when the book was first published, it was very unpopular here. And it drew a lot of criticism, and the newspapers didn't do much to quiet that. They grabbed that ball and ran with it.
People were upset that, what, the secrets were being told? That there were, you know, characters like, what was it, Lady Chablis? Is that the name of the drag queen?
The drag queen, the lady, she didn't know Jim, and Jim didn't know her. I'll tell you that right now.
Really?
They never met. She was a delight to talk to, and was a character, part of Savannah's fabric.
What is it that makes Savannah the place for you, where you settled and live?
I was born here. Never left,
well,
Harvey.
Well, people do move.
Yeah, well, I've been around a little, but I always like to come back to Savannah. I understand the people here. I understand the town.
Sonny Siler, thank you so much for speaking with us.
All right. I'm glad you can edit that thing there.
Sonny Siler, Savannah resident, lawyer, UGA Bulldogs fan, and dog owner currently of UGA 10. UGA, by the way, is the only major college that buries its mascots within the confines of the stadium. So UGA will be there in person, and many others in spirit, when UGA faces the University of Florida on Saturday. I cannot tell you how to bet on the game, but one tip, don't order the tenderloin. Music in this segment from the UGA Redcoat Marching Band. And next Friday, we're going to launch an on-air book club. We'll discuss for colored girls who have considered politics, and we would love it if you could read along and join in the conversation. This is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Next week, Georgia voters will choose a new governor and help determine which party controls Congress. The election is already proving controversial with accusations of voter roll purges, the exact match law, and provisional ballots. Get the information you need before you head to the polls. That's on Monday's On Second Thought. One of the longest-serving prisoners on death row in Alabama walked out of the Jefferson County Jail as a free man on April 3rd of 2015. That man was Anthony Ray Hinton. In 1985, a restaurant outside of Birmingham, Alabama, was robbed, its manager shot. But he survived and identified Hinton as his assailant. Two similar robberies were then pinned on Hinton. Hinton was just 29 years old at the time. He had no history of violent crime and maintained his innocence. A polygraph test given by police exonerated him, but the judge refused to admit it at trial. With the help of civil rights attorney Brian Stevenson of the Equal Justice Initiative, Hinton's conviction was overturned and all charges dropped. That was after he served 30 years in prison, most of it on death row. Hinton will be speaking at Emory University tonight at 7. The event is hosted by that school's Integrity Project and Center for Ethics. Anthony Ray Hinton spoke with my colleague Adam Ragusa.
Were you thinking about how you would eventually tell your story one day when you were on death row? Were you writing this book in your head? Did you think you'd be able to give the world your side of this story at some point?
Well, I had hoped so. You know, one never knows when they're dealing with the legal system. I did know that the legal system had made, I would love to be able to say a mistake, but the legal system didn't make a mistake on my case. I went to death row simply because I was born black, male, and poor. I went to the death row because the prosecutor was racist. But once I got to death row, I began to think about everything that my mom had taught me about fairness, compassion, and everything. But I never thought that I would end up on death row for a crime that I didn't commit. I didn't even think the races of the racist person that stand for justice would openly put an innocent man on death row. But make no mistake about it, they did and they knew that I was not the person that had committed that crime. In fact, one of the detectives told me, he said, I don't believe you did it. He said, but you'll do. And I looked at that detective with tears coming down my eyes, and another detective told me, say, listen, we really believe you didn't do it. But since y'all are always taking up for one another, take this rap for your homeboy. And I told that detective, there's not a homeboy in this world that I would take a rap for like this. And so they knew that those bullets didn't match. They didn't care. Was quoted as the prosecutor once said, we didn't get the right one, but at least we got one off the street.
It was your own defense team. You write in the book
Absolutely.
That your defense
Absolutely.
Attorney told you all y'all blacks always say you didn't do something. That was your defense
Yes.
attorney that said that to you.
Absolutely. You know, it was like the good old boys had got together and decided that we would do just enough to make the legal system seem like we went through the proper procedure. But how would you feel if your attorney come up and don't even speak to you and just look at you and say, I didn't go to law school to do pro bono work? And I never will forget it. I looked at him and I said, would it help if I told you that I was innocent? And he looked at me and he said, the problem with that statement is all of y'all is always doing something and then saying you didn't do it. And this is the attorney then that I knew that I had to somehow try to win over and make him like me where he would at least give me the representation that I deserved. But it didn't work, and, you know, and he went out and hired a blind ballistic expert. And I often tell people the truth. Had I been on the jury, I would have found me guilty because the expert that he went out and got was no expert indeed. And what bothers me more than anything is that the judge allowed this so-called civil engineer, the judge qualified him as being one of the best expert that you could get. And so I knew then that once they start cross-examining him, that I would be found guilty. And it cost me 30 years of my life.
We're speaking to Anthony Hinton. When he was 29 years old, he was wrongfully arrested and convicted for some murders outside of Birmingham, Alabama, and he spent the next 30 years in prison, most of that on death row. He was released in 2015, finally, when his conviction was vacated, and his new book about the experience is called The Sun Does Shine. Anthony, I don't know why this is the detail that sticks at me. It just does. In your book, you write how you needed this racist defense attorney. You considered him your Rocky. He was your Italian fighter. And mm-hmm. then and you were Apollo Creed. And then you write about how 10 years later, I imagine in prison, you saw Rocky IV for the first time. And tell people what you thought when you saw that film.
Well, when I saw it, you know, you always imagine that your attorney will decide that he will give you his best. And realizing that he had made a mistake and I needed this attorney because I couldn't afford an attorney. And as I said earlier, I had to somehow try to win this attorney over to get him to like me. It wasn't about being able to pay him where he come from. I could tell that this attorney was racist. I could tell that this attorney had put every black man in his box. And far as he was concerned, I was no different, no better. I had went out and did a horrible crime, and he had been asked to represent me. And he didn't want to do it, but the judge told him to do it. And so my way of thinking was, come on, let me be your coach. Let me bring you to victory. Instead of you bringing me to victory, let me try to show you who I really am as a person. Don't look at me for my race. Look at me for an individual. Get to know me. And then I had hoped that once he got to know me as an individual, as a person, he would say, you know what? He's different. He's a person that I can work for, a person that I would give my all for. And I really thought that I could win him over. And when I saw Rocky, you know, I finally said to myself, this is the dream. This is what I had imagined that my attorney would do. He would win my freedom and we would run up some steps somewhere. And we would throw our hands up in victory and say, hey, you fought a good fight and we won. And so it just brought back some bad memories when I seen it. And I seen that it wasn't going to work out that way. And I can't even imagine to tell you how it feel knowing that before you even go to court, you already been judged. You already been found guilty. The only thing now left is the sentence. And every judge and every lawyer for the prosecutor and even my own lawyer, I felt betrayed. Not only me, but they portrayed justice. They portrayed and made a mockery out of the system. And therefore, I don't know how anyone could ever believe in the system. Again, after reading and getting to know my case, I just cannot understand how a simple case like this that dealt with ballistics, how an attorney could go out and hire a one-eyed, blind civil engineer, but yet the system allowed this to be who I needed, and they said he was no more than others, and he read and got magazine, and I never will forget when the judge said that, well, he get magazines, and he know more than the average person. I kept thinking, if I was to get medical journal sent to the house, would that give me the right to go out and perform open heart surgery? Because that's exactly what she was saying. Just because this man get a magazine talking about bullets and guns, he was qualified, and my lawyer went out and hired this man. My lawyer never did give me his best. And I want to say to whoever is listening, I don't care whether you're being paid or not paid, you chose this profession, and you should give every client your best. And sometimes your best won't be good enough, but at least you could go home and say, hey, today I gave Anthony Ray Hinton, today I gave this lady, this man, my best. And I tell you the truth, I never did receive my attorney best. I seen my attorney twice in the year and a half that I sit in jail, and I wanted so badly to believe that my attorney would do what he's supposed to do. And even with him making the racist statement that he had made, I still wanted to believe in him. But more important, I wanted to believe in this system that my mom had taught me to believe in. And I'm going to be honest with you, I don't believe in the system, and I'm going to be honest again with my viewer. It's hard for me to believe that a white man would give me his best. And I can't tell you how hurtful that is for me to sit here and say, because I believe that justice should not be about race. Justice should be about that word, justice.
Yeah, you write in the book about how, again, you were seeing your lawyer like he was going to be your Rocky, and you were going to be his Apollo Creed, and then you say that 10 years later, you actually got to see Rocky IV when you were in prison, and you write, it made me glad that I hadn't known that Apollo Creed died in the movie while Rocky stood by and watched.
I kept wondering, did he really understand that I had been sentenced to death? Did he really understand that this is a case about the death penalty? This is a case that, no doubt, if I be found guilty, I'm going to be sentenced to death. Did he care enough to give me his all? Did he care enough to say, I'm going to fight for my client, because if I don't, he's going to be sentenced to death, and there's a great possibility that he would be executed. I thought and hoped in my own heart that he would care enough to say, hey, I'm not going to let this man down on my watch. But he didn't. And I wanted so bad to believe that he would be my Rocky.
You've been out of prison for about 3 years now. You write in the book about how your time in prison, you went through quite an arc. You started off very angry. You didn't speak for 4 years, but eventually, primarily through your faith, you really were able to adopt a very positive mindset that got you through hell, as you put it. You've been out of there for 3 years now. How are you feeling?
I feel good. I have great days and bad days. People to understand that 3 years will not erase 30 years. And for some reason, I still find myself on death row on occasion. I still wake up every morning at about 2:45, and I was woken up every morning for 30 years at 3 a.m. for breakfast. Now I wakes up out of pure habits, because that's the time I had to get up in order to eat breakfast. I find myself showering just like I did when I was locked up every other day on a certain occasion. I still live in prison some days, and it feels like I'm just on a furlough. My mind takes me back, especially during the week of an execution. No matter where I am, no matter where and who it is, I be on death row, because I know exactly what that week is like, the week of an execution. I know exactly what the condemned is being told, and I know that every inmate that he come across is trying to give him hope. And I sit here in this house, and people don't understand that my heart is heavy, and I'm imagine being in that cell, and I know exactly how the guards is treating him, and they treating him this week like a human being, where for the last 10 years, 20 years, no matter what he asked him for, it was always no. But the week of the execution, the guard will go out his way and treat him like a human being. And I wonder sometimes what it is about death that even makes your enemy love you just before they execute you. And so I go through pure hell someday because of what they did to me for 30 years.
It's interesting, as I talk to you, I realize, well, it's evident in your book as well, that you, Anthony, are this, you're a very intelligent man, and you're very charismatic. And I wonder about all of the people who may have been wrongfully convicted in other cases, and they don't have the tools that you have. They're not as effective advocates for themselves as you are. And I wonder what happens to them.
I'm trying to be their sports person. We can sit here all we want to. We can blame the system, but I blame the voters. I blame the people. Every day, the government kills in your name, and the government kills innocent people. The government kills innocent people knowing that they're innocent, but society don't care. Society say you had a trial and you were found guilty. I was found guilty by a jury that the judge told me, a jury of my peers. Now, they got it wrong. Do we really want to kill innocent people? And I often tell people, the only way we will never kill innocent people is that we don't have a death penalty. And the death penalty, the politician need to stop lying to the voters and telling them that they are more safer by having a death penalty. You're no more safer with John Doe being dead than you was when he was alive and locked up in prison. But the problem that we have in this system is that the system is not fair. People see this statue and she got this blindfolds around her eyes, but I promise you, she can see. She know what race you are. She know what college you went to. She know how much money you have in the bank. She know what neighborhood you live in. She know everything she need to know about you. And if you find yourself in her courtroom, she have already put these things together and it have already been determined whether you're going to be found innocent or guilty. That is a fact. We live in a system that is badly flawed, and I don't understand why people will not wake up and say, hey, too many innocent men and women are being exonerated in this country. How long do we need a death penalty? Because if you truly care about innocent people die every day in this country. Had it not been for the civil rights attorney, Brian Stevens, who stepped in and worked diligently and worked every day, 7 days a week, nonstop for 16 years to prove my innocence. If it had not been for him, let me put it in a way that it should be said. Had God not sent this man to me, I surely would not be here talking to you, because the state of Alabama had every intention of killing an innocent man. And they was going to do it in the name of justice. Now, I like to ask the world, I like to ask everybody that going to listen to this, where is my justice? Where do I go to get justice? Who do I see to get justice? Because it seems like no one cares that I've been locked up in a cage like an animal for 30 years, and every day people look at me and they think I'm fine, but I'm not fine, because I live it every day. And I pray to God that one day that this will just be a blank memory. I don't have no memory of where I've been for the last 30 years.
That was Anthony Ray Hinton speaking to our colleague Adam Ragusa. Hinton was exonerated and freed after serving 30 years in prison and will be speaking at Emory University tonight. Well, that is our show for today. On Second Thought is produced by Elena Rivera, Leighton Rowell, and the Raven Taylor. Alex Word is our engineer. Don Smith, our Dean of Grammar. And Amy Kiley is our senior producer. We welcome you into the conversation. We're on Facebook. We're on Twitter at OST Talk. And you can email us at onsecondthought@gpb.org. I'm Virginia Prescott. Thanks so much for spending some time with us. This is On Second Thought.